5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And there was bitterness and tears and recrimination.
Hello, everybody. This is Again With This, Dawson's Creek. Today's episode is Season 5, Episode 3, Cape Side Revisited. And now here are your hosts,
Tara Aranio and Sarah D. Bunting.
And if you think you're recriminating us now, wait till you hear what's going on our sister podcast. Hello, Tara and Dave.
Hello.
Hello, listeners. Before we get into this episode, let's talk about what's happening in the new year on Again With This, dropping Friday, January 2nd. Happy New Year. It is Again With This, episode 270. Let's watch Jason Priestley in Termination Point. Oh my God. It's a new year, but it's the same old 80s techie font, even for TV movies made in 2007, which this was. It co-stars Lou Diamond Phillips and some Colorform helicopters. So far, it's glorious, and it is on YouTube. We will link it in the show notes. We linked to this because we hoped it would be ad-free, but there's a lot of like drop-in crackpot shit about honey reversing dementia. I apologize for that. We do what we can. We hope that you can join us with some of your holiday money again with this podcast.com/club for that discussion and hundreds of others.
Literal hundreds. Crazy mm-hmm. to think about. Speaking of crazy to think about, this episode, it was written by Jeffrey Stepakov, who also wrote the quasi-memoir, The $1 Billion Kiss, about his time mm-hmm. on this show, which I'm like halfway through. It's taking me a while because it's not very good. Mm-hmm. But I will have more to say about it once I get through it. He really likes to show off.
I'm waiting for it to come off hold at the library, so I will join you.
Yeah, he's got a lot of research he did, and he's going to cram it all in there, whether it makes narrative sense or not. Like, buddy, I just want to hear about you. You don't have to give me the survey of how writing works in Hollywood, but anyway, let's start with the D plot. Jack finds out why Sigma Epsilon rushed him so hard. We first see Jack when he's raging at another frat party, playing a video game with Blossom, the guy who invited him to the party in the premiere and who really, I'm going to say, manhandles him when they pull off some play in whatever game they're playing. I'm just saying. I don't remember where this goes.
Yeah.
Just real, you know, the line between homosocial and homoerotic is dotted sometimes.
Yes, perhaps by this guy.
Yeah. And as other guys go by, Blossom makes introductions. One can give Jack tips on his next astronomy quiz. Another one knows Jack is from Cape Side and invites him to go golfing. Jack asks Blossom how he knows so much about Jack, and Blossom says they look into every guy before they try to rush him. And based on Jack's expression, he seems to think that doesn't include knowing that Jack is gay, and he's obviously winding up to come out to Blossom when they hear a cheer and Blossom takes off because a pledge just accepted his bid and Blossom has a new brother. Jack looks on enviously as a crowd sings and hoists the pledge onto their shoulders, and Blossom looks back at Jack all, "This could be you," and we're supposed to think this is a big deal and something to be conflicted about, but I don't really care.
No.
The next morning, Jack wakes up hungover on the couch at the frat house and receives his formal pledge invitation. Clip 2.
What happens if I accept?
You live in the house, you eat your meals here. Your problems become our problems, your success our success. We're your brothers, your family. What do you think, Jack?
I don't know what to think. It's all kind of overwhelming.
There comes a point in every man's life when he has to ask himself that one fundamental question. Am I in or am I out?
Yeah. Yeah, I've asked myself that question, actually. And I think you guys really need to know the answer. I'm gay.
You thought we didn't know that?
Most people are surprised.
Most people aren't Sigma people. You're Sigma people, Jack. You're one of us.
You mean there's other guys in the house that are gay?
You'd be the first.
Most fraternities are not particularly well known for, you know, the tolerance towards alternative lifestyles.
Is that what? I don't think we are still calling them that in 2001, honestly.
No, I don't think so. I think that was like I rolled by like 1991, but I don't know.
Anyway,
could be wrong.
They are known as the hardest partying alpha male frat on campus, and the dean wants them to diversify. So they want Jack to join because he's gay. Sounds great. Who wouldn't want to be a lone token, I guess? Then we're at Graham's house where Jack is telling her about the bid. She thinks it's great, but the very off-screen Toby does not and told Jack they only want him to fill a quota, which Jack says is not untrue, which is, yeah, it's extremely literally true. It was text, in fact.
Yep.
When Graham's asks, Jack says the weird thing is he feels like he fits in there, but he would be the only gay guy in the house. Graham's thinks that it's more of an issue with Jack than it is with the brothers, and he agrees, but it's not typically how he is. Graham says that is typically how Toby is, and if the brothers know Jack even a tenth as much as Graham's does, she is sure they want him for much more than filling a quota. Or for filling something else. Sorry, I just get a vibe up Blossom, that's all.
Yeah.
Then.
Yeah.
It feels like we're picking up in the middle of a scene when we return to the frat house later as Jack is telling Blossom he does not want to join to fill a quota. Blossom says they did originally scout him for that, but everyone there is filling a quota of some kind. Brothers are all cool in unique ways. It's why Sigma's kick butt. Jack says that if he lives there when Toby comes to visit, he's going to be eating and partying and sleeping and showering there. And Blossom's like, that's fine. And even if you don't live here, Toby can crash here. It's his home too, which I'm going to love seeing how Toby's energy meshes with the brothers when Jack's not around.
Yeah.
For one episode, spoiler.
That's some slices of cheese behind the radiator action that I think we'll be seeing. But good luck to everybody.
Anyway, Jack is convinced and tells them to sign him up. And then it is he who is being hoisted on the guy's shoulders. And woo? Question mark.
Well, then his twig and berries are next to Blossom's head. And that's, I think, what everyone wants here. So great.
On to the C plot. Jen and Charlie try a wacky sex fest. We hear tell of Charlie before we see him. Jen has just ordered drinks at a restaurant with Audrey and Joey, more on them in the A-plot, when Charlie booty calls her and Jen gets all blushy and horny. While she's still on the phone quietly talking to him, Audrey asks Joey if they like Charlie, but Jen is keeping him away from the friend group so far. Joey is scandalized and delighted to learn that Jen might actually answer the booty call, and Jen sighs that she needs the snuggles, kicking off an inane conversation about how satisfied girls can be with just snuggles and how guys think of snuggling as a means to an end. Jen says all she's really learned about Charlie in the week she's known him is that his boxers are from The Gap, but in the last episode his boxer briefs were from Joe Boxer. I took a screenshot. Trust me, I know. So Jen does go over to Charlie's, stressing as he starts taking her clothes off that she won't always just show up at his door when he calls. He jokes that she didn't just show up. He could have ordered two pizzas in the time he's been waiting. Deep dish Chicago style, he awkwardly adds to set her up to ask if that's where he's from. He doesn't want to talk about that right now. She keeps peppering him with basic questions about his background until he finally says he's from Highland Park, Illinois, someplace he evidently thinks is uncool, and Jen is gratified to have added a fact to the list. And in bed the next day, Jen asks Charlie his favorite color. The color of her eyes, he says, without much conviction. And she pulls a Louise from Thelma & Louise and covers his eyes, testing to see if he really does know her eye color. But he has. They are brown, with flecks of green, she says. She pretends to be concerned that there's nothing between them except sex and asks if he thinks they could go a day without any kind of sex. Charlie doesn't think they could go 12 hours. She taunts that he doesn't think he could hold out. Charlie knows he can hold out but isn't sure she could, which if one of them couldn't hold out, as they say, Would the other not also be implicated, or are they daring each other to find somebody else who is not in a sex fest to have sex with them? You know, yeah, either both win or both lose, I feel.
Yeah. Also, it's college. Are we actually doing this? I was like literally waiting for a snuffy Walden music cue to drop in to reinforce the proto middle-aged wackadoodleness of this. Like, oh my God, guys, this is what happens when everyone is siloed in their own plots. Nothing of interest.
Whatever. Jen says they're on. He starts kissing her before stopping himself and saying they should probably get out of bed. And later, Jen is bragging that the sex fast is going great. She suggests they fill some of their sexless hours with a Fellini retrospective. Charlie says he can't do subtitles. Jen swallows her natural instinct to call him a Philistine and asks if that's categorical, like he won't even watch subtitled action movies like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. But he will not. Jen pretends not to be bothered about it. He says it's good. They're both learning about each other, and soon the 12 hours will be up and they can have sex again. By nighttime, they're on opposite sides of the room trying to play gin. I'm not sure how. They are 2 yards apart and shooting faves back and forth to see if any match, starting here. Clip 3.
Coke.
Pepsi.
No, no one's favorite is no. Pepsi. It's okay.
I mean, we've had this conversation before. My husband's is Pepsi, I know. It's weird. I don't get it. He's a right-thinking person the rest of the time, but yeah, Pepsi.
Brave to be in a mixed marriage. I'm sorry, I didn't remember that detail about him.
I know. Not all heroes were capes, Sarah.
Here's what's not okay. Jen having her dirty shoes on the comforter they fuck on or near.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I didn't even notice they were playing cards. I thought they were playing some like truth game, and that's where the like Coke and Pepsi type questions were coming from.
Oh, yeah. No, she's got a hand.
But I also was really distracted by her grubby soles on his duvet. Do not do this.
No.
Television.
As they continue not matching faves, Jen gets increasingly frustrated. And when Charlie stands to try to make an impassioned point about ending the fast, he's standing with the computer monitor positioned exactly in front of his crotch so that if they were on HBO, he could like step out from behind it and flash us in a, you know, funny move. But no, what he does do is get on the bed and start kissing Jen, and she's into it, but pauses long enough to say they need to keep trying to find something in common because this relationship eventually has to leave his room. And he agrees, but keeps kissing until he notices they're out of condoms. Jen tells him to go get one from one of his neighbors. I don't know, Jen, get one from your own bag since you should have your own. But Charlie asks why they should borrow when they could steal. Which is why we next see them climbing in the window of the health center, Charlie claiming it's a tradition to sneak in and grab free condoms from a giant vase at reception. Charlie says they're a gift from the class of 1990. Here's hoping you get laid. But Jen says that's not what it says. It's a gift from the class of 1990 in anticipation of a world without AIDS. And instead of getting annoyed at how tacky he is and wondering how many members of the class of 1990 who should have graduated didn't because they died, Jen smirks as she realizes Charlie is nearsighted, which is also why he doesn't like subtitled movies. He can't read them without his glasses. This is another Friends homage. This is why Rachel didn't enjoy the movie on her first date with Ross. Sorry that I know this, but I do. Jen is happy that this field trip actually taught her something about Charlie. He whines that his glasses make him look like a total dork. Clip 4.
You are a total dork. A vain dork.
Although, I thought this was going in a why can't Jordan read direction, and I am relieved that it was merely a lens crafter's problem.
Yeah, we're about to find out how vain Chad Michael Murray actually is. I mean, you listeners will have already heard us talking about The Merry Gentleman, but Sarah's in for something when she sees his hairspray game in 2024.
I mean, look, I've seen the man playing Ted Bundy. I think I'm probably pretty hard to shock when it comes to CMM, but we will see.
We will.
MM.
We will have seen MM by now, of course. But anyway, I say get a guy in a pair of slutty little glasses and he only gets hotter. And you can see proof of this in the visual aids because I found one of Chad Michael Murray in his real glasses. Anyway, they start making out, Charlie grabbing a condom before they sink all the way to the floor. And that's it for the C silo. Onto the B plot. Dawson breaks the news to his parents about how much money they could have saved on him. We open with Dawson thanking Grams for letting him stay at her place as they make up the couch together. I refuse to believe this mansion doesn't have at least 4 bedrooms, but fine. Mm-hmm. She makes a confusing joke about the glamour of having an expatriate stay with her, like it's Paris in the 20s. Ma'am, California's been part of the union for a while. I don't get it.
Yeah. Once again, this episode gave me the distinct impression that it was 38 and a half minutes when it came in and they had to pad. I don't know.
As he receives the Rice Krispie Squares Grams made him for his bus ride tomorrow, Dawson wonders how he can be so sure of something and so nervous at the same time. Graham says that staying in Boston is a big decision. Clip 5.
Well, that I can handle. It's just telling my parents that we're out.
Well, they might surprise you.
Maybe I should just give it more time.
Because of your busy schedule.
Drag him!
Yep. Drag him to the sea.
Dawson admits he doesn't know what to tell his parents. Because the truth is going to piss them off, and maybe he could write a letter. But Graham says if Moses could face Pharaoh, Dawson can face his parents. And then we're in Capeside, and I guess Dawson took the 4 a.m. bus from Boston because the sun is rising as he stands on his parents' lawn with the camera circling him until Mitch appears in the doorway and sees him.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step 3, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Once they're inside, Dawson notices the new couch and Mitch says that Gail has been redecorating since Dawson left. Yeah, why not spend even more money right now? Anyway, that's when Gail herself comes down and is astonished and thrilled to see Dawson home unannounced. Mitch is awkwardly standing with his hands cupped or clasped over his crotch for this whole scene. I'm just saying. You can see it in the visual aids, like 3 different shots of him. Every time they cut to him, just, get the man some supportive undergarments.
Yeah. Meanwhile, his wife is dressed for what looks like work at a boutique at the same early hour of the morning. Yep. Gail has a new haircut. It's cute. But like, why do we have a short sleeve sweater cardi on before you had coffee?
Gail asks if Dawson got the cookie she sent him. He didn't because he hasn't picked up his mail in over a week. His parents assume he's just been busy with classes, but he says he hasn't been in LA. And when they still don't get it, he says he's been in Boston. And they still don't get it. So he has to spell out that USC is not for him and he wants to drop out. He spent his whole summer in LA, went to every one of his classes, and learned that LA is not where he wants to be right now. Boston is because his friends are there. Gail promises he'll make new friends. Depends if he's season 4 Dawson or earlier Dawson, I'll say. But
yeah.
Dawson's had a whole bus ride to think about this, and clip 6.
It's more than that. I'm at a profound crossroads in my life.
I guess this is not strictly a mixed metaphor, but the origin of profound means deep, whereas crossroads tend to be right on top of the Earth's crust.
So this bugged me, but this might be too pedantic.
It bugged me because I think being at a crossroads is like being pregnant. You're there or you're not. The crossroads and the pregnancy do the work. Mm-hmm. And like a crossroads is not profound or not. If it were just a run-of-the-mill crossroads, it wouldn't really be a crossroads. Mm-hmm. Also, how is his parents' first set of questions not, are you okay? What happened?
Right. Well, they know him. I guess if anything was wrong, they would assume he'd lead with that.
Or that it was his fault somehow, which it is.
Yeah, he does love to talk about himself. So, you know, if this is just like, I'm sad and lonely, that's all there is. Because that is all it is, basically. But anyway, go on. Clip 7.
And I know that if I don't choose this path, I'm going to have significant regrets.
Hmm. Where would you live?
With Jack and Jen at Cram's.
What would you do?
I'd find a new school.
Oh, Dawson.
I know I sound like a complete flake, but I promise you, I've given this a lot of thought.
I've given this some thought myself, and I've decided you're not dropping out.
It doesn't work like that, Dad.
If you're going to stand here and talk to me about crossroads and paths, so you can drop out of school and go crash on a sofa, then don't presume to talk to me like you're an adult.
Okay. This might work better, Mitch, if you had not been profoundly unemployed for the first two seasons of this show, but you were.
Yeah. The other thing is, like, you do know Dawson, and you do know that he gets these ideas, and there is apparently no talking him out of them. Like, I think what you have to do is be like, all right, go lay down for a couple hours, and then we're going to talk about how you, Dawson, not us, get your tuition back. Mm-hmm. And get a job in Boston because you can't just find another school. You have to apply, and this is not how any of this works. And on their dime, it definitely isn't. And if it's not on their dime and he's splitting Mr. Brooks's bequest between himself and Joey, then the show needs to say that so that Dawson has a say in where he goes and what he does.
That's when the baby starts crying and Gail's like, I know how you feel. Everyone leaves and Dawson's like, welcome home to himself. Boo-hoo. No one feels bad for you. Later, he's sitting on the floor of what we've come to know as Joey's side of the bed when Mitch kicks off his father-son chat. Clip 8.
When I was your age, I used to spend hours and hours just sitting around thinking about my life.
Why'd you stop?
Well, I guess I got too busy living it to sit around reflecting on it.
I hope I never get to that place.
Oh, God, shut up.
I just... Please put your penis in someone else before making these grand pronouncements. With consent, of course.
Of course.
I just mean...
Of course. I mean, if it really is Dawson's goal for life, it explains why he's so in love with the quicksand of nostalgia that's always threatening to consume him. But anyway, frustrated and exhausted as an infant's parent, two infants perhaps, Mitch tells Dawson to quit fucking around and admit that all this dropout talk is actually about Joey. And if it is, I would like Mitch to accept his culpability in smashing Dawson and Joey together like a Barbie and Ken doll along with everyone else in this stupid town. But Dawson doesn't know so bad about that, because at this point, why would he? And Mitch says Dawson's been making movies since he was a little boy. Dawson started talking about USC when he was 10, and since then, the whole household's project was to get him there. He worked hard and dealt with adversity that would send other kids running for cover, Mitch says, which, like, what adversity? A girl he wasn't dating started dating someone else, and then an old guy he knew died and left him hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like, he has not had it rough. He's had a pretty charmed life, actually.
But Tara, the price of that was arm hair.
You're right. I forgot about the arm hair. Mitch says Dawson achieved his goal and he's thinking about chucking it all away. Is he crazy? Maybe a little, Dawson mumbles. Clip 9.
You want to talk about standing at a crossroads? Fine. But for God's sake, choose your own path.
Dad, that's what I'm trying to do.
No, you're not. You're following Joey down hers. I know how much she means to you. But do you really think it's wise to make major life decisions based on someone else? Remember, this isn't high school anymore. The stakes are high. Your decisions have real consequences.
God, come on. Dad, honestly, do you think I don't know that? You think I don't know that this is the most important decision of my life?
Then make the right one.
Dad, it's not that simple.
It really is. Dawson, I have lived twice as long as you, and I'm just trying to give you the benefit of my experiences.
Dad, I can't live the life that you want me to have. I can't live the life that you choose for me, all right? I have to have my own.
Or to put it another way, clip 10.
I don't want your life.
See, Jeffrey, that's how you write a fucking line of dialogue.
Yeah, just boil it down.
Yes.
Boil it down.
I mean, that was so wordy. It was like the Dawson's Creek challenge to rewrite a line to make it work.
Yeah, or like a run it through. It's like running it through a translator, but English to Dawson's, to back to English, back to Dawson's.
Oh, boy.
But seriously, is someone going to say Dawson and Joey kissed once 4 months ago and since then have had just one inconclusive conversation about it before going their separate ways for several days? Because that's what happened.
Yeah.
Anyway, if Dawson wants his own life, Mitch is fine with that. He whips a plane ticket out of his back pocket and says he booked Dawson on the 3:30 tomorrow. And he then does that thing that tough guys do in movies where they put their face next to the face of the person they're trying to intimidate and talk to their shoulder. Clip 11.
Seize this opportunity, Dawson. Seize it. It'll be gone in a moment. And that's life.
Or clip 12.
Raise the roof! Raise it!
I mean, in the words of the great philosopher Scudworth, shorten it up. I mean, oh my God, you'll see this in the visual aids, but they really are blocked in this way that's like, Tara is absolutely right. It's definitely that tough guy, like, I'm leaning into whisper, not encouragement, but threatening words. This, given certain rumors going around about these two actors, is really like, what are we... Why are we blocking this like this, given that the rumor is that one actor perhaps was killed off to get rid of him? The request of the other one, allegedly.
Well, we'll get there. For now.
Yeah, we will.
Dawson's sitting on a blanket on the lawn with the baby as Gail and Mitch, watching from the yard platform, admit to each other they aren't actually that mad about Dawson ditching USA and being closer to them because they missed him so much. Even when he's being annoying about whatever movie he's just seen. Setting up the final scene of this episode gets a little clumsy. Clip 13.
Do you know how much I love my life? I have this amazing family. I mean, I know everybody says that, but trust me, I've been around the block long enough to know that what we have here is so incredibly rare. Let's just see. It's the only thing I've ever really been good at.
Oh, honey.
Well, no. I'm a family man. I can say with relative certainty that I will never write a poem.
What? A poem?
A poem.
A poem. Go on, clip 14.
Or paint a painting, or make a movie that will change the world. Just wasn't in the cards for me, and that's okay, because maybe... Just maybe. Our son will do that.
Okay.
I hope not. He's tried. It hasn't gone well.
Nope.
Maybe move your chips over to the other kid?
Maybe. Gail gives Mitch a gentle kiss because she loves her boys. And later still, Gail asks Dawson if Joey asked him to stay in Boston. He says no, and no, they're not together. She sighs and makes a face for all of us and shakes her head also for all of us. And Dawson admits that it makes no sense. All his life, everyone has told him to follow his heart, except us. But now that he's about to, everyone's saying he's crazy. Gail just wants him to realize people change. He just needs to make sure being with Joey won't keep either of them from growing. And any way you interpret that, it's clear they already are doing that. They are keeping each other from moving on in life.
Mm-hmm.
Gail is also not dismissing the idea of soulmates, I guess because she wants to keep her job, but Dawson needs to make sure Joey is the kind of person he's willing to make a big leap of faith for. And then Dawson's packing his stuff. And hilariously, when he comes down, Gail asks if he got all his sweaters. Like, there were none left. He took them all. We saw that in the season 4 finale.
Mm-hmm. Not a stitch left in the closet.
No. Gail gives him cookies and makes him promise to eat them. He has hugs for Gail and Lily, and then he has to go deal with fucking Mitch. First, Dawson gives him back the plane ticket. He knows Mitch thinks he's making a mistake, but he's just trying to be the person Mitch raised him to be. Mitch does think Dawson is making a mistake, and he is disappointed. But then he grips the side of Dawson's neck as he says Dawson can never doubt that Mitch loves him. And then Mitch goes out the back door so Dawson can't see him fucking sob. Gail tells Dawson Mitch will be fine and Dawson should call him, which he should do that pretty quick if he's gonna. Maybe he should. Maybe he should call from cab. Which Dawson proceeds to get into out front as Mitch stands weirdly in the middle of the lawn watching it pull off. And from here, they cross into the A-plot. So we will wrap up with them there for now. The A-plot. Joey checks in on Pacey's new life. We open the episode on Jen, Audrey, and Joey being waited on by Karen in Danny's scenestery restaurant. And after some chat about Jen's new relationship with Charlie, which we've already discussed, Joey excuses herself to go to the can, saying she hopes this episode of Sex and the City is over by the time she gets back, and Jen calls her Charlotte. Accurate. But Joey has barely stepped away from the table when the kitchen doors swing open. She freezes because Pacey's face is perfectly framed in the little window and she's dumbstruck. When we come back to her, she's asking Jen how long Jen thinks Pacey has been in Boston. 3.5 weeks, Jen says. And instead of immediately noting Jen's specificity, Joey wonders if she thinks it's been that long. And Jen says she's positive. She clarifies that she only knew he was in town, not that he was working there, and obviously she didn't tell Joey because Pacey asked her not to. Joey says she should leave. Jen, still sounding as half in the bag as she has all season so far, by the way, asks if Joey doesn't want to stay and see him. But Joey says it's been 3.5 weeks. If he wanted to see Joey, he would have, and he definitely would not have told Jen not to tell Joey he was there, and all Jen can do is stare and sigh because all of that is true. And sometime later, Karen storms into the kitchen, which, as we'll recall, is wide open to customers. She bitches that some loudmouth blonde girl sent back her Caesar salad because she didn't like anchovies. And I wish we could have seen Audrey do that because I assume we're supposed to think it was her.
I totally missed that. Does it seem like an Audrey thing? But
I don't know. Loudmouth blonde. That's Audrey to me.
Well, yeah, but she also seems like the type who would love anchovies be loud about that. Perhaps. So, I don't know. Interesting.
Pacey's got his own problems. He thought Danny hired him to cook, but all he's doing is peeling potatoes. These fucking entitled millennials, I swear to God. And I'm just about to make a note about Pacey not wearing a hat when Karen does that, reminding him that there are health regulations, but Pacey sniffs that he would sooner put on chaps. They bicker banter some more about her attitude until Pacey's bitching drives Karen out of the kitchen mid-sentence. And the next day in their dorm room, Audrey asks Joey about the guy she saw in the restaurant last night because they just have been in their charging stations until now, I suppose. Didn't talk on the way back or all night or all morning. Joey only has one guy to focus on right now. It's James Joyce, and she can't get into that until she cleans up her half of the room. Audrey tries to get Joey to open up by saying she was something of a therapist to her friends back in L.A., clip 15.
People would call me all the time to talk about their problems. Some even paid the surcharge to call from the valley. And lucky you, you've got me here whenever you want me.
So I'm pretty sure that was a local call even back then, but I guess it could have been a joke or Audrey correctly assuming Joey's hick ass would not know how phones in L.A. County work.
Yeah.
Audrey has a theory about Joey. She loves school because of all the rules, and she hates relationships because they have none. Joey doesn't deny it. Audrey asks if Joey doesn't want to see this guy, and Joey says yes, no, yes, but only if he wants to see her, which he obviously doesn't. Audrey, clip 16.
God, you're dense. Of course he wants to see you.
What makes you say that?
Because you're beautiful. And you don't know it because you're smart and you don't believe it. You're the kind of girl that guys never get over. Joey, you're the kind of girl that other girls get compared to.
This is some of the most cliche male screenwriter shit I've ever fucking heard. This is like a parody of a bad male screenwriter script. Jesus Christ.
It really is. Like, and they also had her mother tell her this, I think, in a letter from last season. Yes. So it's not only cliched and male-gazy and kind of mean and undermining, if you think about it, but they stole it from themselves. Uh-huh. Great job, guys.
Joey doesn't want to make Pacey uncomfortable, she claims, but Audrey thinks Joey doesn't want to make herself uncomfortable. Joey says things ended messy between her and Pacey, and she doesn't want to make them worse. But Audrey says no one's going to grade her on how things go. We are. Relationships are messy. And if Joey ever wants to have another one, she has to quit worrying about mess. And then we're back to the restaurant where Karen's in a bad mood again. Pacey tries to josh her out of it, complaining that Danny got mad at him for touching a pan. Clip 17.
Put down the ironclad and step away from the stove.
All clad.
Huh? Why would he let you mess with something you don't even know the name of?
Oh, come on. Just hate him with me for a second, would you? You know, nothing will bond two colleagues quicker than bitching about the boss.
We're not colleagues. This isn't a law firm. I wait for people, you cook for them.
No, I don't actually cook for them. I just get to cut their potatoes into paper-thin slices for reasons that are, quite frankly, beyond me.
The whole job is beyond you.
Okay, what's the problem?
He's got you doing classic culinary prep work. You have to wear the hat so that some nice young woman who's here on her first date doesn't puke in the ladies' room and she finds a strand of your greasy hair in her pumpkin puree. And the only problem I have is that I'm working with someone whose sole qualification for this job is his gender.
Well, you see, this is good. We're making progress now because you just exploded on me. I just have no idea why.
The Pacey we knew for four seasons would understand what was behind that Jeffrey. She was pretty clear. My God.
Yeah. Jesus. Although, even though that's like a kind of a dumb rationale, she just told you, and she also told you that you need to stop thinking that you're better than everybody else in the on the staff just because they don't get any lines. Like, put the fucking hairnet on, bro.
Yeah. Then it's nighttime. Joey is wandering bralessly and in the only belt wardrobe bought for her this season, apparently. You can see it in the visual aids. It's like a leather strap with a loop. Anyway, she's walking through the marina to Mr. Kublik's boat. She spots Pacey chopping vegetables. When he looks up at the sky, she comments that it's hard to see many stars in the city. And he kind of acts like no time has passed and it's completely natural for her to be there, saying it's fine not to see the stars here. He has seen them already. She has too. He helps her onto the deck, guessing Jen sold him out, but Joey tells him about seeing him at the restaurant. She brings up the Sunday day dinners at Graham's place and how nice it's been to have a reason not to get lost in the big city, and it would be great to see him there. Pacey vaguely says he'll try to come sometime. Joey would hate it if his not coming had anything to do with her or their bad, bitter breakup. And he jokes that he vaguely recalls that. They dated, right? She barely remembers now that she's dated half the football team because she had to leave the other half for her roommate. Pacey jokes some more about how sorry he feels for the person confined to close quarters with Joey 24 hours a day. And then she clumsily brings up an article she read for biology. Classic Jeffrey Stepakoff, I now know from reading his book. About there being a time soon when human beings will be able to regrow brain cells so that people can forget all the bad stuff and only remember the good. Pacey thinks that's already possible. Aw. He asks about her roommate. Joey wants to know about his job and this amazing boat. And the camera guides up to the starless sky as Pacey chatters about himself, as one loves to do. And when we see him next, he's in the kitchen at work, showing Danny the 42 pounds of thin potato slices he has sliced. Danny says it looks like he was getting the hang of it at the end and then picks up the bowl and dumps it in the trash. Pacey flips out to see all his work discarded and demands to know why Danny would waste Pacey's time and his own money on this exercise and then not even use the potatoes, calling Danny a whack job to boot. Danny says it was training, brings Pacey to another station, plops down a white truffle and tells Pacey to cut it the same way he did the potato because that's what Danny was teaching him to do. White truffles cost $1,200 a pound, and if he set Pacey loose on them without training, he really would be a maniac. Pacey is aghast at the price until he tastes the slice, once again tipping his whole head back to, like, drop it from the ceiling into his mouth instead of just eating it normally.
Yeah, also, an entire slice? And we're just throwing away 50 pounds of potatoes now?
Yeah.
Okay, Elon, like, this is not how restaurants work. This is not how truffles work. No. This is not how anything works.
But this is the moment Pacey gets it. Clip 18.
Karen has more discipline and motivation than a slack ass like you will ever have. But this isn't kickboxing. And that's why I wouldn't give her your job.
She wanted my job.
You're not going to pick this up through sheer will. Cooking is a craft which can't be taught. However, it can be learned.
What?
Unlike writing.
Also, it can't be learned by Karen because she's a woman. Just wondering, because that's what she thinks. And if that's the kind of culture you created at your restaurant, maybe you should think about that and work on it, dude.
I still think they might be fucking secretly, but mm-hmm. Guess we'll find out.
We do hear that tomorrow's Pacey's going to be cooking the truffle ravioli, which I doubt it. Take no. Three on the job. I don't think you get to cook anything yourself then. Back to the dorm. Joey gets back. Dawson's waiting for her on the stairs. When he asks, she says her weekend was strange and unusual. His was strange and unpleasant. He alienated his parents and is adrift in a sea of uncertainty. He asks her to promise him that he is absolutely making the right decision and that it will have only positive repercussions on his life, which, you know, he could say something like, I made this decision to be close to you because I have romantic feelings for you. Do you reciprocate them? But these two stupid assholes refuse to be clear. It's driving me crazy.
Oh.
She repeats something else she heard from her sociology prof, which is, there's no right or wrong, just the consequences of your actions. Dawson grumbles that he might as well get on a plane right now, but Joey reminds him that they tried that and it didn't work. He's like Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man. She can offer a cup of coffee, and as they walk out, she asks how Capeside was. And it's kind of hard to hear because their conversation fades out over a shot of Mitch coming out of the convenience store with two bags of groceries, but here it is, clip 19.
They turned down the new Yale, building in like a new 16 theater multiplex.
Nice to show you.
What?
Never go home again.
Why does every fucking person who works on this show refuse to learn the quote? Oh my God. It's all been building to this. Mitch drives home, singing along with Drift Away on the radio, and aggressively gesturing with his two-scoop ice cream cone. Before long, he has flicked them onto the floor of his car, and instead of realizing, as any of us would, this ice cream is lost to him and he can hose off the floor mat when he gets home, he undoes his seatbelt, ducks down to pick up the ice cream with the cone, I guess, and clip 20.
Give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away.
Mitch is dying! It's still funny.
I mean, just... What? You know what? It doesn't matter.
That's the best you could think of. Like, we're about to find out in the next episode the other driver was asleep. Like, we didn't need the ice cream part. He could have just been coming around a curve and gotten hit by someone in the wrong lane.
Yeah.
The ice cream part makes him look like an idiot.
Why was this a series wrap on The Flash?
It's not quite.
Really rude.
We get to see flashbacks of him in the next episode, so they gave him a little bit of dignity, but that this was his ending? Oof.
I hope he's still mad.
He should be.
Yeah, he should be.
Well, that's the episode. Let's close it up by naming our MVP. I'm going to say Grams for that slam on Dawson. It was brief, but he deserved it.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of options here, so I will also say Grams because she also apparently is a real estate flipping fucking mastermind. To get this giant house with stairs and like multiple dining rooms where all these boneheads can stay. Good job, Grams.
Yep. Least valuable player. I mean, is it blaming the victim if you're victimizing yourself? But I have to say, Mitch, that ice cream is gone. Let go.
I mean, we come not to praise Mitch. But to bury him and the floor cone. Let it go.
There's no
let it go, brother.
There's no 5 second rule on a floor mat.
No.
That food is dead. Don't eat it. It's dirty. Dirty.
Next time on Again With This, as noted, we come not to praise Mitch Leary, but to bury him in nostril-flaring self-absorption and Emmy trolling that is, so pack some cucumber slices for that eye roll strain. And you'll also need them for checking out our visual aids. We do key screenshots and GIFs for every episode of this podcast. You can find those along with the episodes themselves on our website, againwiththispodcast.com. I'm Poetic License, D. Bunting, and I'm on Blue Sky at Sarah D. Bunting. My co-host is Precious White Truffle Tara Ariano, and she's on Blue Sky at Tara Ariano.
The whitest.
And our producer, David T. Cole, can never go home again. Talk to you next time.
I'm at a profound crossroads in my life.
Step off.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.